And our rooted topic this week is why and how should I tell people about Jesus? And so I think the first thing we need to say is this. The landscape has changed. The environment has changed. 75, certainly 100 years ago, if you didn't attend church, you were seen as suspicious. I heard the story this week of a man who 75 years ago, 80 years ago, went to a lender, to the bank, in an attempt to get a loan. And as he was answering the questions, one of the questions he was asked is, what church do you attend? If you called yourself an atheist, you were not to be trusted. But if you went to church, you were seen as trustworthy. Lenders are not asking you that question anymore. There's been a shift. There was a time when Christianity influenced American culture, but those days are far gone. Even in terms of what it means to be a committed Christian, a disciple today, in Grandma's day, if you weren't at church on Sunday morning, Sunday night, Wednesday morning Bible study, Friday night prayer group, if you weren't in church at least four times a week, you were backslidden at best, or you might not be saved, you know? That's how Grandma looked at it. There was a lot of pressure to be at church. Now there's pressure not to be at church. And what happened? What happened was, in part, the 60s, on into the 70s, there was an epistemological shift, a change in the way people think. It's been referred to as an egalitarian epistemology. It's the idea that no one idea is any better than another, but all ideas are equal. And now truth is like beauty. It's in the eye of the beholder. We're told that to tell anyone what they should or shouldn't believe is wrong, which in itself is a self-contradictory statement. But it is what it is. It typifies the age that we live in. In Ravi Zacharias' book, Can Man Live Without God, which I highly recommend, he writes about being in a car, and the driver is explaining the different sites along the way. He's actually going to give a lecture on the campus of Ohio State University, and his guide points out the Wexner Center, which is there on the campus. And he said, you know, this is the first postmodern building in America. And Ravi says, postmodern building, what exactly does that mean? And he said, well, the designer designed it with no design in mind. And it's sort of, it imitates life in that it's random and senseless. So you go inside and there are stairways that lead nowhere. There are pillars that support nothing. And it's just an ode to postmodernism and how it is a reflection of life. And so Ravi says, let me get this straight. The designer designed it to mirror everyday life and its senselessness and its randomness. And the driver says, yeah, that's exactly right. And Ravi says, did he do the same thing with the foundation? See, what happens is Christians bring objective truth. They bring absolute truth into the conversation. And it is foundational. And when you start messing with the foundation, when you start blurring what is foundational, you set yourself up for all kinds of disaster, all kinds of pain and heartache in the world. And so here we are, the foundation of reason and belief is being rewritten, but it is very dangerous to undermine foundations. And so as a result, many Christians, most of us are seen as trouble. We're seen as archaic and narrow-minded, and therefore, to many people, we're just, you know, it's flat out, we're just bad for society. So here's what's fascinating to me, though. We are in many ways just like those Christians that lived 2,000 years ago in Rome. You know, we have these ancient documents that reveal of all the groups that existed in the first century, Christians were most despised. Nero, the most powerful man in the world, blames Christians for the fires in Rome. There were a lot of groups he could place blame on, but he placed blame on Christians. Why? Because Christians refused to pay homage to other gods. Remember, first century AD in Rome is a polytheistic society. Every city had its patron god, and within that city, there were union gods. Right? There's the god of the blacksmiths, the god of the leather workers, all that. So you had all these guys. And then when you traveled from your city to another city, you were expected to pay homage to that city's god. And so what happens is the Christians show up and they're like, no, we don't bend the knee to any god other than the true God, our God. And so Rome was like, excuse us? See, and then you would become blamed for any bad that happened to that city because you were the ones that weren't appeasing their gods. And so Christians were, they were seen as trouble. They were not wanted. And yet, Christianity began to spread like wildfire. Why? There was no cultural advantage to being a Christian. I'll tell you this, Christianity spread, but it wasn't because Christians invited their friends to church. Because the minute you set foot in a church, you're immediately labeled, oh, you're one of them? Oh, okay. What happened? See, there are so many parallels to the time in which you live right now, the time in which those early Christians lived. How did it happen? What's the difference? I think in many ways, the big difference is Christians are responding in very different ways. I think what's happened is we've become silent. Why? The field is no longer level, we feel. There's no shared ground. 50, 75 years ago, it felt so much easier. You had a conversation with people about God. You could share with them a little booklet, the four spiritual laws, and there was this assumed sense in modernism that there were laws that governed things. And wouldn't it make sense there are spiritual laws that govern things? Now when you talk about God, it's like he, she, it. Additionally, let's just face it, Christianity has had some really bad representatives, and people love to talk about the sins of others, and this becomes an excuse. People are very quick to highlight the sins of the church. You try to have a conversation with someone who's younger than you, even from a younger generation, and you realize they value autonomy much more than they value truth. So it's like it's offensive to their post-truth sensibilities to imply that you want to convert anyone. How dare you? And I think also Christians have just lost their love for the lost. And I think a lot of this has to do with the fact that there's a weakening sense of the joy of their own salvation. So under Roman Empire, the situation was very similar to our own times. What can we learn from those who thrived in that environment? So here's what we're gonna do. We're gonna look first at Jesus' example, and then we're gonna look at an example of one of the earliest and most effective evangelists of all time. And you may already know who she is, even though she's unnamed, okay? Now that your curiosity is there, in John chapter 4. Jesus has this way about him. And he's constantly throwing curveballs. He's constantly shocking his disciples. So I'm going to summarize some of the text for you for the sake of time. Jesus, at this point in his ministry, he's becoming very popular. And he's drawing the attention of the religious leaders who are looking at him like and going, it was okay when he had a few ragtag followers, but now there are thousands of people wanting to hear what he has to say. And so that poses a threat to their authority. And so they say, we got to do something about this guy. Now, ultimately, these are the ones who will deliver Jesus up to be crucified. And so they start pursuing Jesus. And Jesus finds out and he says, okay. He says, we're going to get out of town. We're going to cool it for a while. But then the text explicitly says that Jesus is going to travel into Samaria. In fact, the text says that he had to go through Samaria. He's traveling from Jerusalem to Galilee And in between is this region of Samaria. Now, those of you who are familiar with the story already know that rabbis especially did not step foot on Sumerian soil. Why? Because Sumerians were considered half-breeds. They were part Jewish and part Assyrian from way back in the day. And so to a rabbi or a full-blooded Jew, Assyrians were seen as dirty half-breeds. They didn't associate with each other. If you understand the conflict between the Israelis and the Palestinians, that gives you an idea of the conflict in Jesus' day, right? So Jesus goes right on through this Sumerian territory, which is taboo. But Jesus doesn't care about that. There's somebody there that needs him. He's with his disciples and they approach a well. And they stop to rest. The disciples are sent into town to get some food. Text tells us that it's during the hot part of the day, a woman comes out to draw water. I agree with those commentators that make note. It seems that this is actually reveals who this woman is. She's an outcast in her own society. First off, she's a Sumerian, but she's a Sumerian outcast. She's there by herself. She's not traveling in the safety of other women during the cool part of the day, but during the hottest part of the day, she's out there by herself. So this kind of gives you an indication of what kind of woman that she is. And then we find out some more details later that affirm this. And so she's there and Jesus actually approaches her. Here's what happens next in verse 7. When a Samaritan woman came to draw water, Jesus said to her, "Give me a drink." His disciples had gone into the town to buy food. She replies, "You're a Jew. How is it that you're asking me for a drink?" And then you get this parenthetical statement, in case you don't know. Jews did not associate with Samaritans. So Jesus asked for a drink. This isn't done. Her response indicates that she knows this. Wait a minute, you're a Jew. Not only is Jesus a Jew, but remember, he would have the appearance of a rabbi. Rabbis especially don't talk to women. And then when we find out what kind of woman she is, as Jesus will reveal, it's like we talked about a couple of weeks ago. Jesus always brings this humanizing element into his conversations with people. And it's like the thought of a rabbi sharing a drinking cup with a woman like this is just scandalous. I mean, this is front page headlines. Rabbi shares drinking cup with Samaritan woman at the well. And this is exactly what he does. Why? If you miss this, you miss pretty much everything. Jesus is about to enter into a conversation that will bring her life. But what he does first is this. He loves on her. He shows her love. I'm telling you right now, in this day and age, the way we reach people with the message of Jesus Christ is to lead with the love of Jesus Christ. It's Christian love that opens the door to the message we want to bring to people. And the challenge we have today is that too often, if in the Christian community, it's kind of an us versus them mentality. And if there was ever a them person in Jesus' world, it would be her. This is a very, you know, John is very good at including these accounts from the life of Jesus. See, previously he's talking to Jesus, encounters someone who's super wealthy. He's like, "Hey, I'm for you, rich people. Rich people need me too. Y'all are chasing after these things, but your soul will only be satisfied in me." Then John turns the corner, chapter 4, and he's like, "This woman that nobody wants, this reject, yeah, Jesus is for her too." And what does Jesus do? He humanizes her. Remember that? He humanizes her. You have people in your life that are crying out to be loved. They are in desperate need for this kind of attention. And it changes her. So, she says, "How can you ask me for a drink?" And then Jesus replies by saying, "I've actually got some drink for you. I've got some water for you. And you drink my water, you'll never be thirsty again." And she says, "This is amazing. You mean I won't have to come to this place in the hottest part of the day?" She's not quite tracking. She says, "I want this water." And Jesus says, go bring your husband. And she says, I don't have a husband. And Jesus says, you're right. You've actually had 5 husbands. And the husband you have now is not yours. Now, why would Jesus say this? Why would Jesus bring this up? The conversation was going so well. He brings it up because he's offering her the solution to her problems in life. You say, how so? It's as if Jesus is saying, you've been going to all kinds of wells and you've been trying to drink from them. And what you're looking for in those wells is to have your soul satisfied. But now we're talking about 6 husbands later, and that well still isn't satisfying your soul. Now think about it. He's just kind of gently pressing in on what she knows to be true about herself. And this is a way of Jesus saying, I have the solution to your problem. You drink from my well, and you will never be thirsty again. You take from me what I have, and your soul will be satisfied. That's compassion. So in front of her stands a man that knows the details of her life as only someone supernatural, a prophet, only a prophet could know this kind of stuff. So we got to give this woman more credit than what is often given to her, because at this point, she asked Jesus a hotly debated question. Now, some commentators think that she's doing this as a smokescreen to kind of throw Jesus off the trail, like it was kind of a hard, difficult conversation. I don't think so, because later on in the text it says she has an awareness that the Messiah will answer theological questions. And she's wondering, now wait a minute now, this guy just told me some stuff about myself. Only a prophet could know. I wonder, could this be the Messiah? Let me throw out a question, a theological question. And so she says, you people, the Jews, you say the proper place to worship is over here at the temple in Jerusalem, but our people, you know, we have a different location. So which is the right place? Who's right and who's wrong? Now, this is a great opportunity for the conversation to go in a completely different direction. But Jesus doesn't allow the conversation to get sidetracked. And this is huge. Sometimes we fail to tell our own stories, right? We fail to enter into meaningful conversations with people and tell them about Jesus because we get easily sidetracked. Well, you know, what about the dinosaurs? Okay, well, what about gender identity? What about sexual identity? You know, what do you think about those things? I'm not saying that we shouldn't have a response to those questions, but what I am saying is we shouldn't get sidetracked. The emphasis is, this is what Jesus has done for me. And we keep the focus on Jesus. And that's exactly what this girl is about to do, as you'll see. So she says, she asks her question. Jesus says, the place really isn't important. It's not the location. It's not the physical location. That's not the important thing about worship. The important thing about worship is the location of your heart. Where is your heart before God? Location isn't important. But the condition of the heart, where is your heart located? As proof of this, Jesus will look at the guys who are supposed to be, you know, the most religious. And he says to them, you don't know God. Yeah, you visit the temple every day and you perform what you think is worship. And you don't know God. See, it's not the location. It's not the physical location. It's the location of your heart. Where is your heart at? So she says, okay, all right, you're kind of talking a lot in the ways that the Messiah would talk about how he's supposed to talk. When the Messiah comes, he will answer these questions, and you kind of answered that question. And Jesus says, I am he. I am the Messiah. And he reveals to her who he is. Now, that's the familiar part of the story. Now for the part of the story that perhaps you're not so familiar with, verse 27. Just then his disciples come back. and they marveled that he was talking with a woman. The word marveled can be translated as astonished. They are shocked. They're like, what is he doing? But no one's going to say to Jesus, what do you seek? It's like, what do you want from her? No one's going to say, why are you talking with her? So the woman left her water jar, that's enthusiasm, and went away into town and said to the people, come and see this man who told me all that I ever did. Can this be the Christ? And Christ means Messiah. So they, the people, went out of the town and were coming to him. There's so much here. This is so beautiful. She runs into town. She says, you got to come and see this guy who told me everything I ever did. Me. He talked to me. Me. The woman that none of the other women, none of you other women want to be around. You don't want to take the trip to the well with me. You don't want to talk to me. You don't have anything to do with me. But this guy spoke to me. Can you believe it? It's almost like in this statement, the emphasis here, he spoke to me. She knows who she is. And you got to love this about her. This is really the first part of embracing what Jesus has done for you, is to see yourself as you really are. And she comes in time and says, it was me. Yeah, you know me. You all know me. You know I'm out there by myself. You know you don't want to be with me. You're not taking the journey out there with me. You've seen me with the different guys. And yet Jesus spoke to me. So she's absolutely overwhelmed, watch this, by the love and acceptance of Jesus. He didn't see me as dirty. He didn't see me as a second-class citizen, as a woman. He didn't see me as a dirty half-breed. He didn't judge me for where I was at in the moment. And he accepted me. And now, because of that, she can't help but say, you got to see this guy. Yeah, I've been convicted this week, you know, with her response, because when there's a new restaurant that opens up that I'm in love with, you're going to know about it. Why? Because I'm excited. There's this joy. You know, it's like, hey, did you watch the game? Did you watch the game, the ASU game last night? They went for a 2-point conversion. It's okay. Have you seen this movie? I gotta tell you about this movie. Have you been to this restaurant? Oh man, the food is so good. You gotta go. And I think what's happened for many Christians is this. It's almost as if we've lost the joy of our salvation. And because we've lost that joy, this kind of joy, the joy that this woman has, we're not super motivated to talk about it. So Psalm 51:12, David says, restore to me the joy of your salvation and uphold me with a willing spirit. Now, by the way, we should note the thing that robbed David of his joy was sin. That's the thing that robbed David of his joy. But David refused to stay in his misery. He comes clean with it. He gets it out there. He seeks for forgiveness. He calls for the restoration of his joy. And I love this woman. She doesn't say, hey, just take my word for it. She gives this personal invitation. Just an ordinary person, not a gifted evangelist. She hasn't had evangelism training. She just says, my life has changed, and I got to tell you what's going on. This is the way Christianity spread in the first century and beyond. When this church started, you know, we gathered in my living room with about 20 people. We began to dream, and I got to tell you, those people, you know what? They were bringers. They brought people to church, but more importantly, those people were tellers. And what I mean by that is they invited people. Let me tell you about what Jesus is doing. Just by living their lives, they had this attraction, and they would step into these spaces and they would say, let me tell you what Jesus has done for me. And then it made people want to come and be a part of what they were already a part of. But they were already, that's why this woman, this is the first evangelist. She's extremely effective. So I got to tell you what happened to me. Come see a man. And she takes people right to Jesus. And while she's in town telling her story, this is what happens with the disciples, verse 31. Meanwhile, the disciples were urging him, saying, Rabbi, eat. Remember, they left him. They went to buy food. They come back with food. But he said to them, this is so brilliant. He says, I have food to eat that you do not know about. Now, when you're spending time with Jesus, you're constantly kind of going, okay, he said something. I got to think about this. Okay, just one sentence from Jesus, and you're like, okay, now, what? He's constantly doing this. Everybody's hungry, we're going to buy food, come on. Jesus, here's the food. I have food that you don't know about. Okay. Has anyone brought him something to eat? Like, Peter, did you slip him something, you know? Did you give him something on the way here? I mean, Jesus said to them, my food is to do the will of him who sent me and to accomplish his work. What is the context? The context of that is Jesus revealing himself and who he is. Jesus says, you know what evangelism is like to me? It's like I wake up in the morning and I don't have to think, am I going to eat today? I don't know. No, you don't even think about it. You know you're going to eat. You know you're going to drink. And Jesus says, giving people life, it's like eating and drinking to me. Do you not say, there are yet 4 months, then comes the harvest? Look, I tell you, lift up your eyes and see that the fields are white for harvest. And a couple of commentators make an interesting observation. They believe it's possible that when Jesus says, look, see the fields? They're ready for harvest. It could be that the townspeople are now coming out to see Jesus. Guys, look. My belly's full. Doing the work of the Father. Bringing people, finding the lost and getting them saved. Already the one who reaps is receiving wages and gathering fruit for eternal life so that sower and reaper may rejoice together. For here the saying holds true, one sows and another reaps. I sent you to reap that for which you did not labor. Others have labored and you have entered into their labor. Telling people about Jesus is like planting a seed that leads to eternal life. And so Jesus says, this food is my food. It's a joy. There's joy not only in the reaping, but there's also joy in the sowing. This is really important. It's like, you know, you dig a little dirt. So we have these barrels in our backyard, right? They're like those whiskey barrels that are cut in half that are like little planters. And so my daughter's been growing some stuff in there. I told you a few weeks ago, she turned vegan on me and she's actually being pretty serious about it. Pray. So she's growing all this. She's growing like her own stuff. Like she's really getting it self-sustaining. So she's growing this lettuce. But it begins with, it put this little seed in the ground and you cover it with dirt and you're like, well, kind of looks exactly like it did 5 minutes ago. And what Jesus says is, be joyful. Be joyful that seed's in the ground. Sower and reaper, they both rejoice. See, some people say, well, I don't know. I mean, if I step out in the space and I share what Jesus has done for me, I don't know. You know, it's like, will anybody respond? Jesus says, you know what you're doing? Be joyful. You just planted a seed. You just planted a seed. So there's joy in the sowing and in the reaping. So I asked several Christians what makes talking about Jesus challenging. Number one answer, fear. Number two, just don't think about it that much. Number three, pessimism. It's the doubting that God can really work in that person's life. So how do you overcome fear, doubt, pessimism, indifference? Joy. Having the joy of your own salvation restored. That's how you overcome those things. And I think bottom line is this. None of us really sees ourselves as the woman at the well. We don't see ourselves as that Samaritan woman at all. It's like you ask someone, are you a Christian? And they'll say, yes, of course I'm a Christian. You ask a woman at the well type Christian, why are you a Christian? And they'll say, oh, man, I can't believe I'm a Christian. I can't, I'm like, they laugh. They say, can you believe God reached out to me? I mean, a wretch like me, can you believe that God reached into my life? I was the woman at the well, and Jesus showed up and said, I'm for you. And when we begin to see ourselves more like the woman at the well, the more we're motivated to bring that kind of joyful salvation into the lives of other people. The attitude isn't, yes, of course I'm a Christian. The attitude is like, can you believe it? Can you believe what God did for me through his son, Jesus Christ, in spite of who I am, because of who I am? So this lady is unnamed, but she will go down in history as one of the greatest early evangelists of all time. She had no theological training. She didn't attend a seminar on how to share your faith. What she did have was a story, and she told it out of the joy of her own salvation. And you have the same thing. So Father, as we leave this place, I pray that you would put us in that spot of the woman at the well, and you would also put us in the place of David, where you would stir within us the fact that you reached into our world and you did for us what we couldn't do for ourselves. Not that we loved you first, but that you loved us. You initiated. And so, Father, in all of our spheres of influence, with the people that you bring into our lives, I pray that by the power of your Spirit, you would lead us into those conversations. Sometimes we sow, sometimes we reap. Matters not, because there's actually joy in both. We ask this in the name of your Son, Jesus Christ, and God's people said, amen.